You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ellen Harvey. Ellen, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's my pleasure.
Ellen, let's talk about what you're doing. You're in Brooklyn now, right? I'm wondering what's happening in your studio at the moment.
Right now, what's happening in my studio is that I am cracking open bottles of champagne, both literally and figuratively, because I've just finished painting something that I've been working on for a year. So I'm actually really happy because I've just finished this crazy 1,000-square-foot painting that's going to be used as a design for a glass project in the Miami Beach Convention Center. And people will get to see it this Miami Basel this December. Assuming the fabrication goes all right. But I finally finished painting this thing, which has almost done me in, and I'm just so insanely happy.
Wow. Well, congratulations on that. I wish I could share some of that champagne with you. And this is a great day to talk about that. So tell me a little bit about that. How did that commission happen, and why did it almost do you in? What was? Tell me a little bit about the process and why it took over a year.
Well, it's a huge design, and it's going to be made on mirrored glass, a sort of dark handmade mirrored glass that looks almost like water, and it's going to be this sort of drawing in white. And for reasons that do make a certain crazy sense to me, I decided I would make the design life-size by hand. And the design, it's 10 feet by 100 feet, so it's 1,000 square feet. And it shows a diagonal view of Florida literally going from Miami Beach all the way to the Everglades. And it's sort of, because it's going at 45-degree angles, just sort of magically halfway through, the halfway point is where the Everglades start. And from then on, it's all development all the way to Miami. And so I've just been painting this crazy aerial view of, you know, swamp for half the year and Miami Beach and the suburbs for the other half of the year. And it's all been black and white, so I literally have just been seeing, and it's very, very detailed, that I've been seeing all those sort of tiny black and white houses or bits of the Everglades floating in front of my eyes. It's based on satellite imagery for a year. And I wanted it to be a piece that is about this sort of, it's about sort of two systems almost of water management. I mean, it's two ways of dealing with the landscape. And I want it to be about how these systems are almost too large for us to grasp. So it is the piece, like many of my pieces, is, you know, inevitably a failure. I mean, you'd be better off actually just with the satellite photo, but it's about this sort of attempt to this very human, sad attempt to grasp something that's just too complicated, and it really has been purgatorial. I think it's going to be quite beautiful, perhaps too beautiful, who knows, but I've lost all sense of perspective at this point. It's just done.
Wow, that's a huge kind of process, and what a way to end it all. So, tell me a little bit about that, because as much as it's hard to grasp, you've still been going over every single detail. So, in some sense, you have grasped it, or you've studied it in a way that no one else has. We could have used a satellite photo perhaps, but here you've gone over every single square inch of this massive landscape the way you've done it. How have you understood it? Do you really feel that you don't understand these two water systems, or maybe I should ask, why are they ungraspable? What is it about it that's hard for us or for you and us to grasp?
Well, I think when you look at something like the Everglades, it is this tremendously complex natural system, and it has all this complexity, and it has all these different sort of structures, and it's almost impossible to... It is just too complicated. In some ways, the human structures that are built by us are easier to understand because mean, they are built by us, and I can look at them. I mean, well, that's definitely a road, I think. Yes, that's a road. So I'm using all these government, you can order all kinds of satellite images from the government at a very reasonable cost. It's remarkable what they'll sell you.
You've been working from these satellite images. Is that the main source?
Yeah, so it's all been based on these satellite images. And, it's done, which is exciting. And I wanted a piece also, people go to convention centers and you're in this artificial world. You have no connection to where you physically are. And one of the things that makes Miami Beach special is its connection to water, but it's also the thing that threatens it in a way. And at the same time, the whole sort of story of Florida is the story of the relationship between all these people who moved there and then, of course, the natural world that was there before, and that part of which has been saved, of course.
Right, in the Everglades. This will be on permanent display, or is this will be a permanent public work, or how will it be installed?
It's a permanent piece. It'll be made in glass, and then it'll be installed, and it'll be in front of the main ballroom.
So that's fantastic.
You go into the ballroom to go do whatever one does in the ballroom, I suppose, have a ball. So you
refer to this as a failure, and of course I'm sure it's really not a failure in the sense that it's the piece is completed and I'm sure it looks gorgeous. But why do you feel it's a failure, and how does that contrast with what the audience will kind of interpret when they look at this work?
I don't know whether, people will judge it however they want to judge it. You can't control that. Hopefully the sheer craziness of the amount of attention that I've paid to it will be something that will make people think about this sort of about land use and where they are. But at some level, all these things are just too difficult for us to really grasp, I think. I think of all of my works as failures in some way. I mean, the book of mine that last came out was titled Museum of Failure, because I think failure is really what makes art art. I mean, it's the one place where how can you judge if an artwork is a success anyway? It doesn't have any real function. It's in some ways it's the reason it works is that it's connected to our sort of very human desire to make something extraordinary, and yet we always fall short. That's what it is to be human, and that's why people care about art. It's this sort of gap between desire and fulfillment that I've always found really fascinating. So I think that's why people care about art, is because it fails.
But is that also why how does that compare to who we are as human beings? Aren't then, by extension, we are all failures as beings?
Well, I don't think of it as being such a bad thing. I think that the idea of success is actually more problematic. Like, how do you define it? What is it? We all do things and we all dream and then we go away. It's okay. That's sort of how I think about it.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the Museum of Failure, which was your Whitney Biennial project. Is that correct, in 2008?
That was my project for the Whitney Biennial, yes. I mean, that's actually a very dark project. I mean, actually quite a lot of them are quite dark, I suppose, but cheerfully dark. That's a piece.
So let's talk about that. Yeah, how that began. I mean, obviously that was, the Whitney asked you to be in the Biennial, but then how did you come up with that Museum of Failure? And could you kind of walk us through that a little bit?
Well, as a child, I'd always loved museums, and I'd always loved the sort of the glamour and the excitement, and the fact that people had made all these things was so extraordinary that other people had made these things, and perhaps I too could make things like this. Perhaps I could be part of this sort of big, chatty, talkative world of objects in the museum. And as I got older, I became more and more worried about how that would actually work, and I started to think more and more about why, what should I really be doing as an artist? Like, what's my real function? And it became less and less clear to me, and there were more and more things that I wanted to deal with that I couldn't figure out how to deal with in art. And in some ways, I mean, I think Museum of Failure was kind of a nadir, because it was this moment when there were all these things I wanted to talk about and I couldn't figure out how, so I made the world's most sort of tragically circular artwork, where it's this sort of big mirrored wall that's engraved with a collection of empty paintings with light behind it, so it sort of glows on the surface of the mirror. And then you can look through it and you can see a collection of the same collection of frames, but this time it's a sort of trompe l'oeil painting. And then you look into the frames and you're like, oh, thank God, there's some subject matter, but then it's just me in my studio painting that painting. So it's a piece that's about this sort of glorification of this, of the, this, of the artist's studio that at the same time is completely empty. I think it's probably one of the reasons I do such a lot of work outside of the studio as well, is partly because I've always found the studio both seductive and difficult. And that's, that piece was really about that.
And there was also a performance associated with that piece, wasn't there?
There was a performance, but the performance was actually a completely different piece. It was a recreation of a piece that I had done on the streets of New York called 100 Free Portraits, where I'd always felt that people, you know, people always wanted portraits when you're in, at least if you're an artist, you don't know what kind of artist you're going to be or should be. If you're like me, you listen a lot to what other people suggest, and people would always be like, oh, well, you should do a portrait of my daughter or whatever it was. And I always think, I wonder why that is. And the more people said it, the more I started to think, well, maybe it's more interesting than I think. And so I went and became a street artist for a little while on the streets of New York, and would sit outside of institutions and offer people free 15-minute portraits. They weren't particularly good. And then they had to fill out a form evaluating their portrait so that I could get an idea of what they liked or not liked about their portrait, and then I mailed them all off to them after I'd scanned them. And I did the same piece inside as part of the Whitney Biennial, and it was called 100 Visitors to the Biennial Immortalized. And there, of course, it was completely different, because on the street it was all about giving people this free gift. But inside the institution, suddenly it was all about denying thousands of people something that they wanted and giving right. The gift to a very few who had signed up in time. And suddenly, instead of everyone complaining about the shoddiness of their portraits, which is people had been felt quite free to do on the streets, suddenly it was all about how lovely it was to meet me, which is, of course, gives a really, I mean, context really is everything when it comes to art. You know, it really is fascinating.
Right. I mean, that's I certainly understand that, and we should explore that more, because I was in the Whitney Biennial and a little bit earlier than that, and my wife and I were giving out free hugs and foot washings out of our studio.
I remember this piece.
You remember that? So then they said there was one ad that they had to change, because it said, you know, free hugs and foot washings from Praxis, asterisk, free with Whitney admission. So, you know, of course, it wasn't really free, and remove the whole idea, and even the idea of, at that point, we were giving away money too. We couldn't do that, because it would just seem like a refund. So there's something about, especially in the project that you're talking about, that changes completely when it's in a museum. And because of that, I mean, in our case, it also was my wife and I, a type of failure, because it no longer had the feeling that it had when people were just happening upon our storefront on 10th Street. But with what you're doing, it also, you know, falls short of the original goal. And does it also become an institutional critique at all, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I think anything that's in an institution, I think, is inevitably, in some ways, is an institutional critique, because it's engaging with the institution, and you can be honest about that, or you can pretend it's not there, but it's still there. You know, so it's not that it's going to sort of magically disappear. So of course it is. I mean, the two projects together in some ways are the institutional critique, I would say. But at the same time, it was also kind of an experiment. It was fascinating to see how much more sort of important I had become through this, just because suddenly I wasn't sitting on the street, because I was sitting in the Whitney Biennial. I'd become suddenly way more glamorous than I had been previously. Didn't last very long, but But it was, it was. I mean, I was surprised at the strength of the effect.
Of the Whitney biennial effect, you mean? Yes.
I mean, on people's reception of the portraits, because I hadn't got any better. It wasn't as though I'd been practicing in the intervening years.
And some of your work, I mean, of course, seems very difficult to collect, including the piece in the Whitney, although obviously those portraits and the portraits you were doing on the street, is that something that's possible? Is most of your work now public oriented work, or is there also work that's able to go into homes or private collections?
I've always been a grasshopper. I've always been somebody who's bounced furiously from sort of seductive idea to seductive idea. So I'm not somebody who sort of has one big thing that they do. I do a lot of different things. And so I work with four galleries and I make shows. I just had a show at Danese Cori in December called Nostalgia. And I mean, there was one very large installation in it, but then there were lots of smaller pieces that, you know, were collector size that were all about various explorations of the idea of nostalgia and the problems of nostalgia. And at the same time, I also make a lot of pieces that are public art commissions. So I do quite a lot of public art commissions, which, you know, is also fun. I mean, I got to destroy a church in Belgium. I mean, who gets to do that, right? And then I also try every, you know, couple of years at least to do pieces that are just gifts that I can give away. So I like to operate in a sort of variety of different ways. Just because it feels limiting just to be in one kind of distribution system to me. They all have different sort of strengths and weaknesses and beauty.
So tell me about destroying a church in Belgium. I don't know about that, and certainly most people don't get a chance to do that, and it sounds kind of wonderful and horrific. Tell me a little bit about that project.
Well, it's in a very small village with about 600 inhabitants called Bosset, not that far from Brussels. And the mayor who was the mayor of sort of five of these little villages, had too many churches. I think they're all godless heathens in Belgium now, so they don't go to church enough anymore to support as many churches as they have. And the churches in the area all look quite similar because all the old churches were blown up in World War I. So in sort of the 1920s, they rebuilt all the churches, and they all, my guess is it was probably one firm that just did them all because they all look identical or more or less identical. And there was this church, and he didn't know what to do with it. He was going to tear it down. And legend has it he went out drinking, and one of his sort of constituents said, you know, well, you should ask for an artist for an idea. So he went to see the Belgian national architect, who contacted a couple of artists. I was among them. And I flew to see this undistinguished, but otherwise, you know, intact 1920s church. And I sort of said, well, if you don't have any money to look after it, it's going to become a ruin anyway. So, you know, why not just make a ruin? So I thought we should blow it up and have a big party, but that proved to be impractical. So we had a sort of more controlled demolition and took off the roof and everything inside. And then we kind of made this outdoor space because people in the village had said they really wanted a public space where people could gather. So we made it into this sort of ruin with this beautiful terrazzo floor that showed all the things that had been taken away. So this, you know, the altar, the pillars, the roof. And then over that in the terrazzo, we also had the shadow of the previous church, what it had looked like as a ruin at the end of World War I. So it's also sort of a memorial to the previous St. Amalberger. And I have to say that going to the opening of that was probably the most nerve-wracking opening I've ever gone to, because, you know, despite all the research, I was quite worried that people would start throwing things at me. But in fact, it's been a huge hit. They've gone, the people in the village have used it for all kinds of things. It's now sort of a destination. They have concerts there, and the teenagers put on this sort of light show in the summer, and suddenly it's become this thing that the village has that makes the village different. And people are very excited about it. I did a show a year later in Bruges, And they chartered a bus to come and present about their church. It was really fantastic, all the stuff that they'd done. They really made it happen. And now it's getting toilets, which is, we all know it's the real vote of approval. So
that's fantastic. So when you talk about all the imagery in it, of the past church and the terrazzo floor, is that embedded in the floor, the imagery of the past?
Yes, it's a very simple drawing in black, white, and gray. So you have to imagine a kind of drawing in the floor. It's white terrazzo, and then you've got sort of gray outlines of where the pillars were, of where the altars were. And then over that is a shadow, also sort of done in terrazzo, but so the white bits become gray and the dark gray bits become black, of the previous church. So it's quite a simple drawing, but it's easily recognizable.
I love that. Yeah, that's so fascinating how something like that can turn into a wonderful public space, because that's awesome. And you say that God lets heathens in too many churches, but really, and they may be, but also there's this, I would like to think that church, which I don't really attend or haven't really attended, I should be clear, ideally a meeting place, something for the community to gather and talk. And it's kind of wonderful that space has now become that, and in such a way that it's so flexible, from, as you're saying, light shows to concerts and other things. That's not how you planned it, though, to be initially that flexible, or was it?
No, I wanted it to be a container. So I did want it to be flexible, because we did this whole survey of the village to see what people wanted. And there was a strong view that people wanted more green space and more communal space. And I also felt strongly that, the church is called Repeat because, of course, it reflects the craziness of humanity. You have this perfectly lovely old church, you blow it up, you build another one, and then you rip it down again. It's completely mad. And yet, at the same time, that desire for some kind of communal space, some space where you can do things together in a kind of larger symbolic way, is so important. And if the church itself as a church isn't providing it, I wanted to make a space where you could both remember its previous function, but also kind of transition into something that was a little more flexible, so people could do whatever they liked. So people have actually used it for some religious things as well, I think, funnily enough. So it's had this multi sort of purpose rebirth in a way, which has been great.
That is great. So let me ask you, the work that you do and our conversation so far, speaks to a certain kind of intellectual rigor of your approach and practice and a questioning and a research that although you talk about it in a kind of almost whimsical way, it's quite strong and powerful. And I know you went to Harvard University and Yale Law School, as well as, which is kind of a remarkable combination, the Whitney Independent Study Program and PS1's program. All of those things together seem to be such an unusual combination. Do you see the, especially Harvard and Yale Law School, as a contributor? How does that mix with the Independent Study Program, which really sends artists out to the world on a specific conceptual framework often? But then you have a very unusual background that's different from all the other artists. How has that knowledge, is what I'm asking, shaped your work and career?
I think I was always interested in systems. When I was at Harvard as an undergraduate, I studied utopias. I was obsessed with utopias, which I think in some ways, this sort of idea of communal fictions or fictions of how we organize ourselves and organize society, that's always been incredibly important to me. And that's probably also part of the reason I was interested in law, though a large part of it was because I'd gone to the Hochschule der Künste in Berlin and had dropped out and had got into Yale Law School, applying in an attempt to become a slightly more respectable citizen. And I couldn't really imagine how I would support myself as an artist when I was a young person, to be perfectly honest. It didn't seem likely that would work out. So I went, and it was only really once I'd been a lawyer on Wall Street for a couple of years and was, you know, this is a fantastically privileged thing to be able to say because I was out of debt by that point. I was like, well, I could just save money and quit. And the worst that would happen is I'd have to get another job. But I knew I wanted to be an artist. It was pretty clear to me. I was constantly, I was already exhibiting. I was doing stuff with other artists the whole time. So I was this art school dropout that had almost dropped out of law school, then gone back to law school, had taken off, you know, half a year before starting to work to paint, and then had started working, and then decided, I just thought, you know, I'm 28. I mean, at the time that seemed incredibly old, but I thought I was so old. But I should now do what I wanted to do, and you know, I would somehow make it work. I was very, very determined at that point, and probably quite lucky. But in some ways, I think it's been helpful because not having sort of some non-art world experience does make you think about the strangeness of the art world in a slightly different way. You think, well, you know, why do we have this category of people who are artists who, in some ways, are not really good at anything useful? You know, what makes something art or not ornamentation? What's the difference there? Why would you have art? You know, you could imagine a society without art, and I obviously would hate to live in that society because I absolutely love art, but in some ways, a lot of the questions that have motivated a lot of things that I've done have come out of questions that I was interested in all along. To the world, it seemed like a very dramatic break, but it didn't seem like a very dramatic break to me because I had been obsessed with art since I was very young. I'd always wanted to be an artist. And at the same time, I'd always been very interested in these larger questions of, you know, why are things organized the way they are? Shouldn't they be maybe organized differently?
Right. Well, so much of your work, that's fascinating. And so much of your work, as we've discussed a little bit, is about questions. And we've talked about failure a lot. And you've talked about artwork itself as failure. Yet, you know, this contrast with yourself as arguably a success, right? You've done very well. You're a full-time artist now, and we're in prestigious shows and programs, and continue to be. How do you kind of come to grips with both of those things? Are they running against one another? You know, this idea of failure and examining so many things, and at the same time, you are a success in the context of that most artists think in terms of exhibiting and showing and public artworks and having an income from that. Maybe I should just ask this directly: when you decided that you were going to be an artist and as you said, just really put your mind to that, how is it that you began to get shows, and what did it mean to put your mind to it? What was it that allowed you to suddenly go out into this very strange world where there's, you know, so few guidelines and be able to be an artist? Was it some of those things that happened? And I know this is kind of a mouthful here, but I'm really asking how did your success occur in terms of you deciding that that's what you're going to do? I mean, a number of artists decide that, but they don't always have success. And of course, luck plays, a strong part in that. But nevertheless, it would seem that you also had a peculiar foundation to come into this in terms of your background. Did that play a big part in it? In other words, Yale, Harvard, with the independent study, in terms of actually becoming an artist and succeeding in a classical sense in the art world?
I mean, to be honest, I think that the reason that I started showing at all was other artists, and that was partly because I was a fairly sort of shameless and relentless young woman. I mean, anyone I thought was interesting, I went to talk to. I went to see everything. And other artists invited me to things. It really was, in many ways, the generosity of other artists that sort of got me my foot in the door. if you can say that. And
but you were also pursuing the door, it sounds like, breathlessly, right?
Otherwise, I was going to be stuck in an office again, which I really didn't want. Part of me was, I just wanted to prove that I could do it. I just thought, well, you know, I have something to say. I have something interesting to say. And maybe it's not, you know, that great, but there's plenty of stuff out there that's also not great. I could be not great among all the other people. I think it was helpful also to have sort of been in a career that I didn't like. Because, you know, as a young lawyer, you're working, you know, often 80 hours a week on things that you really don't care about. And it made it seem in some ways quite easy to work hard at things that I really wanted. I really wanted to become a good, you know, as good an artist as I could. I wanted to be, have something to say and to say it and to think about what it was I wanted to say. And I feel incredibly lucky because I feel that, you know, what's better than this? I get to think of things to do, and not always, but often I can find places to fund them or to make them happen. I mean, that's an incredibly luxurious state of affairs. And if you've worked in the world outside of the art world, you realize, you know, how crazy it sounds to people. You say, oh, I'm going to do my work now. And someone says, well, who told you to do it? Who's paying you for it? And you're like, no one. I mean, that makes no sense outside of the art world.
Absolutely.
Which is probably why you've written all those books, trying to explain it.
Yes, probably. Ellen, it's great talking with you. Before I ask you the last question, is there anything that that you want to mention before I ask you the last question, or that you wish I had asked?
Well, I think the only other thing that I would talk about is that I do have a show up right now at the Children's Museum of the Arts in Manhattan that is all about ornamentation, because I became weirdly obsessed with ornamentation as a result of a project I did for the Barnes Foundation, and also all the public artwork I've done, where I feel that there's been this interesting shift in the world where, you know, you kind of have somebody like Luce writing about ornament and crime, and then ornament gets stripped out of public space and replaced by advertisements. And yet at the same time, with the rise of our current president, you see that, you know, ornament is alive and well in some parts of the sort of kleptocracy. And so I've been very interested in that. I think that's been the other thing. That's the thing that I've been doing a lot of work on, as well as this crazy piece about Florida.
Right. Well, congratulations on that being done. And also the show at the Children's Museum, there'll be a link to that so listeners can go see that or know where that is. I also wanted to ask you what you're reading at the moment. Could be anything.
I'm actually reading, just finished reading Parade's End by Ford Madox Ford, because the show that I did about nostalgia made me think about, and that's a sort of fantastic book about nostalgia and the sort of end of an era and the ways in which... coming from the UK, the ways in which the class system is both kind of glamorous and poisonous at the same time, and there's this sort of fascinating character who's sort of the hope of the novel, who's this young suffragette, which somehow also seemed like a appropriate thing to be reading about right now.
Ellen, I want to thank you for talking with me today. I've really enjoyed this.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.